An alcoholic. Good evening and welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a few points of housekeeping. We will only be recording and publishing the audio portion of this meeting. And for those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. And you guys can wave at the screen if your video is on, or you can raise your hand virtually. We'll see you in the participants window. Anybody in their first 30 days? I see Allie. I'll try to unmute you so you can introduce yourself. Bear with me.
Hi, I'm Allie. I'm an alcoholic. This is my 20th day sober.
Awesome.
Welcome.
Super cool. Glad you're here, Allie. Wonderful. Anybody else in their first 30 days of sobriety? All right. Great. And anyone can use the chat function if they like to send their phone number to Allie at this time. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we are discussing step four, part two, which happens to be fear and sex. And please welcome our panel this evening. We're super excited to have Shannon and Mike. Woohoo! Awesome. So I will read the first paragraph, which tonight can be found on page 67, and I'll also share that on my screen. And then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. So, as promised. Page 67. Well, let me read the steps. Step four is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. First reading is on page 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, the employer, and the wife. The short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And tonight we're going to start with Miss Shannon. Take it away.
Hi, I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 15th, 2015. I have a sponsor. I'm not a sponsor. I'm willing to be, which is kind of all that matters, I've heard. So I actually recently just did an inventory in fear. Oh my God, it's not joking when it says, you know, it's my life is shot through with it. And I do love, I say this often, but I love how the Big Book uses strong language, because, you know, it doesn't give me an opportunity to find a loophole or argue or, you know, do whatever I need to do in my head to make it not apply to me, or to try to play anything down or minimize it. Like, when it talks about fear right there, it calls it an evil and corroding thread that has shot through my life. And like, that's intense. And I remember the first time I read that, I was like, God, is it really that serious? And like, yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, one of my old ideas that I go back to a lot, because it comes up on my inventory all the time, is, you know, I think I know the answer. And that is a direct offshoot of my fear that I do not know the answer. I think if I can arrange everything, everything will be great if everybody just listened to me. And really what it is, you know, I'm scared to go out into the unknown. And, you know, I don't know what God's will is. So I'm scared to not do my will, because what if I don't like God's will? And what if it's not fun? And what if it's hard work? You know, all these things that scare me, you know, and I look at this on my fear inventory, and it's so basic. Like, my fears don't have to be this super outlandish stuff. You know, some of it is, but some of it is as simple as, you know, one of my big ones, my first one on my inventory this year was, you know, what if I can't connect in AA? Like, my fear is I won't be able to connect in AA. Because, you know, I'm younger than everybody else, and, you know, I just graduated, and I don't have a career, and I don't have a husband and children or a house. Like, I literally currently live in my parents' house, rent free, because they're in New York, and I'm like a child. I have no idea what I'm doing. So, you know, this fear keeps me from even trying to go out of my way and call people and make connections. You know, it keeps me stuck in the same spot, and it makes progress incredibly difficult when I am paralyzed with fear. And, you know, if anybody knows me, I think they know that my image doesn't really go too far. Like, I like to try and act like a tough guy. Like, you know, I've got like all the piercings and the tattoos, and I walk around with a mean face and my hood up and my headphones in. And oh my God, it's so far from true. It's like I'm just a big teddy bear inside. And, you know, I constantly have to look at, where is my fear driving my life? And I have to get that fear removed with a higher power. And there's another spot in the Big Book. I can't remember which step it's in, because I'm a bad alcoholic, sorry. But it's... you know, it says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. And I like that, because it doesn't say I just let it go, or I just forget about it, or I'm just like snapping the fingers, I'm not scared anymore. I have to outgrow it, which means I have to do something. I can't just be like, okay, God, remove the fear, and then just sit there and twiddle my thumbs. Like, I've got to do something. Nothing in this program, you know, just magically happens. I mean, there are absolutely some things that are just like, beyond explanation, like the obsession to drink being removed, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that I cannot ask God to do for me what I can do for myself, because the book says that God will do the exact opposite of that. God will do what I cannot do for myself. You know, so I always thought fear was an attitude, or, you know, a mindset or something like that, but really, And it is to a certain extent, but the only way for me to get out of fear is to behave differently. You know, I can't do the same thing all the time and then wonder why I'm still having the same fears. That's all I got for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Shannon and Mike. Mike, you're muted. You should be able to unmute yourself.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's January 7th, 2008. I have a sponsor. I sponsor a couple guys. And my home group is 49th Street Living Sober. And we meet Thursdays at 5:30 down by ODU. But we We haven't done that a lot recently. We're on Zoom still, so please come see us. I always start a lot of my shares with this, especially when we're talking about fear. And when, if you're new, when we talk about this stuff, don't think you're not, you know, I always thought when I first came into AA, when you guys were talking about all this stuff, I was shocked. I didn't know any of it. I didn't know what you were talking about, you know, because I went to high school. I went to health class. I guess I heard a little bit about alcohol in health class, but I thought I missed it because you guys were set. You guys were straight. You were laughing. You were talking about how you quit drinking and all of this stuff. And I was like, what are they talking about? What in the world are they talking about? So if you're new, I'm telling you a lot of stuff that happened, has happened to me since being sober. It by no means is what happened right away. And I didn't know this stuff when I first got here. So if you're new and you're hearing all kinds of things, that's okay. Just for a while, listen and we'll help you. You know, about fear, when I was drinking, if you had told me that I was afraid of anything, I'd have laughed at you. I wasn't scared of anything. I got arrested twice. Nothing happened. Bring them on. What are they going to do? I'm not going to stop anyway. So I'm not afraid of that. You know, I wasn't afraid that I was hurting anybody. I wasn't afraid that I wouldn't have enough money because I always somehow did, not realizing I was spending money I didn't have, stealing money, didn't matter. I wasn't afraid of anything. And I'm not a big walk around, oh, I'm a tough guy. I'm not that at all. You know, Shannon said she's the big teddy bear. I'm the biggest teddy bear in the world. But when I was drinking, that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing that's talked about in the big book comes in, and I could have cared less about any other person, even myself. If you wanted to come and party and drink with me, please do. And if you didn't, I was cool with that, but I wasn't scared of anything. And then in the book, it says this short word somehow touches every aspect of our life. And I didn't know this then, every decision I made was through fear. You know, I would look at something, and when I was drinking, I say, should I buy this? I don't have enough money. We as a family don't have enough money, but I'm going to go drink anyway and spend all the money on alcohol, and somehow we'll get by. That's okay. You know, or I'd miss work a lot, and I'd miss work on Mondays and Fridays, and I'd pick my Mondays and Fridays because I didn't know this, that I was afraid that people would catch on. But somewhere in the back of my head, I thought, maybe they're going to catch on that I'm missing a lot of Mondays and a lot of Fridays. And I wasn't afraid of it. I still took the days. You know, I'm going out drinking, or I'm feeling bad on Monday. I'm not going. And one of the worst things that the fears that I didn't know were relationships. You know, I used to never talk to my parents after I started good and drinking. I wouldn't talk to them afternoon of any weekend because I was probably drinking, and my mom called me on it a couple of times. You're slurring, you know, you told me that story last week, and I was afraid of what they would know how much I'm drinking, but I didn't, like I said, I didn't know that then. You know, I'd tell my kids I would be somewhere, or I could pick them up, or I'll be on time. And I wasn't, and I was scared they would think I was a bad dad. And I was a bad dad, but when it came down to getting a drink on, I just did it, you know. And my wife, I would just kick back and say, you know what? She's a big girl. She knew what she was getting into when this happened. And that's so selfish and so terrible. But then when I got sober and I got with a sponsor, and I think that's very key for people new to here, and we sat down to do an inventory, and he showed me how to do it, and we went through the big book and did it together. Man, that last column, fear was in every single, like it says in the book, aspect of my life. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune. Every single thing I did had fear next to it. I stole some money. I could have lost everything, career, job. I would have went to jail. And when I was doing it, I wasn't scared of it. I just did it, you know, but that came up in my inventory. I was scared to death. It scared me then, later, you know, all the things that I thought I was okay with, that it was my fault. It was just because I was scared. What are they going to think of me? What are they going to do with me? How are they going to love me like this when I've done this and this and this? And I was just scared. And it's a terrible way to live, but it's what I did for a long, long time. I just lived in fear. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Next up is page 68. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Shannon.
I was listening, I promise. I don't know if y'all are much for praying. My mom just texted me, and our cousin's drinking again, apparently, started about an hour ago, and she's not in a good way. So go ahead and send some prayers her way if you're into that. But yeah, relying on God, speaking of, you know, I don't keep me sober. That was the first thing I learned in AA, was that all I have to do is the steps and the work and pray, and God will do it. You will not. And that helped me so much, because honestly, it took me off the hook, because I was panicking when I first came to AA. I stayed in AA for about a year before I even asked somebody to be my sponsor. Because my parents thought I was sober because I was going to meetings, and that way I could drink. But, you know, that was such an important lesson for me to learn, that it wasn't like everybody else in the room magically knew what they were doing and somebody just told them the secret of how to get sober. It's on the wall. It's the steps. Like, it's not a big secret. I just have to do the work. But if I'm relying on myself, you know, there's that part in the book that talks about being the director of the show, right? Where if everything goes my way and everything's fine, everything will be cool. And that is so far from the truth, because I mess stuff up. When I look back through my entire drinking career, I was always like, okay, this is the right thing to do to make sure that XYZ doesn't happen. And then X, Y, or Z always happened. I could not control things the way I liked to believe that I could. You know, and the same thing is true today. It's not just my drinking. I can't control much of anything, really. And the more I try to force my will, you know, the angrier I get, the more resentful I get. You know, why are people not acting the way they should be acting? This should is a huge thing for me. Oh my God, the amount of times that should comes out of my mouth a day is unreal. And you know, that's something that gets me in trouble, you know, because it says, you know, if I'm relying entirely on God, if God is really in charge now, then I'm going with it. You know, then I have to surrender my will. And that's a difficult thing to do. It's something I have to do every day, sometimes multiple times a day. like, you know, I'll catch myself, because always in the morning, you know, I pray, I'm like, God, help me do your will, not mine. Say a little ditty of the third step prayer, you know, and then I go about my day. And sometimes if I wake up at 9:30, by like 10 o'clock, it's done. It's over. I'm doing my will already. I'm trying to arrange my day. I'm trying to get everybody else to choose their role in my day. And it's that level of needing to control things ultimately comes from fear for me. And I love that they say, you know, that spirituality is not the way of weakness, because that was exactly my belief when I came into AA. It was like, these people are crazy. And they're just, you know, they're putting it on God because they can't do nothing for themselves. And I thought it was just this whole big, everybody's tricking themselves into not drinking and God definitely isn't real, whatever. And again, you know, my first sponsor put it in a way that I could understand. And she said, if God's not real, you're screwed. And I was like, ooh, that's a good point. And, you know, so I've gotten to the point where, you know, I absolutely believe that there is a power greater than myself. And there was some Irish guy in a meeting one time who was talking to me after the fact. And, you know, we were talking about God and how we got to where we are in sobriety and all this stuff. And he said to me, he said, yeah, it's interesting that I thought it was me who could be the highest power ever when I can't drink a beer and keep my life together. And I was like, wow, okay, another excellent point to the fact that I should not be in charge. And, you know, it took everything it took for me to finally get the message that you know, me trying to run my life goes very poorly. And relying on God isn't really all that easy, because sometimes I want what I want and I'm going to do what I want. And it doesn't really matter if I pray or meditate or tell someone, I'm going to do what I want, even if I do all those things. And it gets me into trouble. When it happens enough times, you know, I'll learn my lesson. Or if things are going badly enough, I will learn my lesson and turn back to, okay, I need to turn my will over. And I don't do it on purpose. You know, the way I just described it sounded very intentional. But really what it is in my head, I got this. Everything's going great. I got it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is everything is not going great because of me. You know, and I do that thing where if stuff's going great, then I love God and we've got a great relationship. And if stuff sucks, then it's all God's fault and I'm done with this. And you know, it's very childish. It's very bratty behavior. And, you know, sometimes it takes a lot to pull me out of that mindset. But, you know, that's why it's important for me to go to meetings and talk to people. Sometimes even just hearing myself say something out loud, I'll be like, that's crazy. What you just said is insane. And, you know, it just makes life so much easier when I do turn over my will. When I know, okay, here's the work in front of me that I have to do and the rest is out of my hands. You know, I'm not trying to mold everything to my ideals, because first of all, my ideals probably aren't even really all that great. And second, I'm not going to be able to make it work anyway. And, you know, when I am on a good spiritual basis, when I'm taking regular inventory, when I'm actually going through, you know, spot checks throughout the day, it just goes so much smoother, because it just keeps driving that idea into my head that, like, I cannot be in charge anymore. Because as long as I was in charge, I was piss drunk all the time. I got thrown into various treatment centers all throughout high school. You know, I would steal money from my parents for cigarettes. I mean, anything, nothing was off the table. I'd find pills, like loose pills, like in our drawers in the bathroom. And I'd just take them. I don't know what they are. It doesn't matter. Maybe nothing will happen. Maybe something will happen. And it's like that is what I will absolutely go back to if I think I can run my life long enough that I think I'm in enough control that I can drink. And that'll happen eventually if I'm trying to control everything else and I think it's working. You know, I will get some pretty far-fetched ideas. And so I have to stay in this, and I have to stay connected, and I have to stay honest, and I have to stay connected to a higher power. And, you know, I probably, would hate myself if I could hear me saying this when I got to AA, because I'd be like, oh, you gave in, you conformed. It's like, yeah, no, what you guys were telling me was the absolute truth. It works. So I don't really care if God or Allah or Yahweh or whatever is real. All I know is the God idea works. And that's all I need, is something that works. Doesn't matter what it is. And it's working for now. So that's all I got.
Thank you, ma'am. Mike?
Yeah, I think what Shannon said earlier when she's talking about the language in the big book, the language in this book is strong. It goes right to you, man. It gets you. And I used to hate this book because all I could understand about this book was, oh, that I did that, that's bad. I did that, I was bad. I did that, that was bad. And that's not what it is about. You know, that first paragraph we read was, you know, all about fear. Fear runs our every aspect of our life. It sets in motion trails of circumstances which brought us misfortune. God, that doesn't sound good. You know what? What do I have to look forward? What in the world is, what am I looking forward to? And then we get to this and it says, look, just trust and rely on God. I'm going to show you how to do this. We're going to help you do this. And, you know, nowhere in this book does it say we still won't have fears when we turn our life over to the care of God. We're going to have fears. We're human beings. Like, but there's ways, now we have the tools. Like, I don't fear going to jail anymore because I don't put myself into positions to go to jail anymore. You know, I don't fear not having money. I could end up broke as anything. But today, when I practice these principles in all my affairs and I do what I'm supposed to do, I don't go out and frivolously spend money on anything, you know, on a case of beer every single day. I don't do that. In relationships, I don't fear talking to my parents anymore. I don't fear telling my children and my wife, this is where I'll be. This is what I'm saying. This is what I'm doing. You know, a long time ago, if my wife looked at my computer or my phone, I would be done. I'd be dead. That would be it, you know? And nowadays there's no fear of that because I'm doing the right thing. You know, I'm just in this world to play the role that God assigns. You know, David knows this, but last weekend I got in a really, really, really bad car accident with my son and he was driving and it wasn't good. And when it was over, we walked away, but the fear that I had was, and it's still playing in my head sometimes, is seeing him, my son, in the car next to me. And I wasn't going to call my sponsor. I wasn't even going to tell him. And my wife, I'm so lucky that my wife said, you need to call your sponsor. You need to call him. And I said, why? She goes, because you're afraid. It's running through your head. And I said, well, I don't feel like drinking, you know, whatever. And it's not about that. That fear of that accident was taking over me. I couldn't do anything else. I didn't want to get in the car. You know, I don't want to go anywhere. That's how we get places, you know. And I'm lucky to have somebody there who said, hey, you're being fearful. Take care of it. And, you know, when I called my sponsor and I read some stuff in the book and when I prayed and talked to God, you know, that fear went away. What I think is the most amazing part of these two paragraphs is it says, the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their gods. And without a sponsor, I never would have read it like that. But it says their God. And this goes back to step three. You know, this book, everything connects. I choose my God, the God of my understanding, to help me get through this life, not yours, not the next person's. Like Shannon said, there's a lot of gods that you could pick from. It doesn't matter. And that's the part that, you know, when I went to rehab, I ran to the cool kids. I'm 45 years old, but I still ran to the cool kids who said, they're going to throw a Bible at you. They're going to talk about God. And I said, well, that's my way out because I don't believe any of that. And that's not what it's about. It's a spiritual program where I choose a higher power a God of my understanding to help me get through this fear and get through all these character defects and get through this life on life's terms and play the role that he assigns me, not the role that Mike wants to play anymore. When I was drinking, I was the sun. You guys were the planets. You revolved around me. And if you wanted to go, we went. That was it. And that doesn't work like that. You know, anytime that I'm fearful or any of that, I just relax, calm down, say a simple prayer, you know, talk to the God of my understanding. And we get through this. You know, nowhere, I'm going to say it again, nowhere in here doesn't say you're not going to have fears. You are. You're human. But we have ways now to calm down and take it easy and talk to a God of our understanding that can help us get through this. That's all I've got for that. Thanks.
Thank you all so much. We're going to stay on page 68 for the next reading. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Shannon?
I got to think for a second. So I'd say probably the most important line just in that little paragraph, because there's a whole lot more coming after it about God shaping my ideals and the whole bit, but I won't jump ahead. I am not the arbiter of anybody's sex life, you know? So it doesn't matter what you're doing. I have no opinion on it. You know, it doesn't matter what I'm doing, regardless of whether or not you have an opinion on it. That's me and God. And, you know, when I did the sex portion of my inventory recently, I've never done it this way before, but my sponsor had me do it as all the big relationships in my life, every major significant relationship in my life, romantic or no, physical or no, just every major relationship. And the way that you go through a sex inventory gave me so many new insights on, you know, how I treat these people. And it's not that I'm treating everybody poorly, by the way. I don't want to make it sound like I'm some monster, like tearing through everybody's life. But, you know, it goes back to that should thing, right? Like, what are my ideas of them? What am I trying to get from them? And, you know, I think that's how, I mean, that's how human beings have relationships. There's always somebody getting something from both parties. You have to be getting something from that relationship in order for people to stay in it. And I have to look at my motivations. I have to look at what is it that I'm expecting from them? What do I think they should be doing? And, you know, it can be the simplest things. Like, you know, with my mom, one of my big ones is like, you know, she should agree with me. And it's like, no, she shouldn't. Who came up with that? I did. That's such a load of, I'm going to watch my language. It's BS. I made that up. I make it up. She doesn't do it, then I'm mad. Are you kidding me? That's insane. I do the same thing with my sister, right? And, you know, she calls me all the time and she just wants to talk about nothing. Like, she'll call me. I'll be like, hey, how's it going? She'll be like, good. I'm just on my way home from work. What's up? And I'll be like, nothing. And then it's like, okay, why'd you call me? And, you know, I see it as such an imposition on me. And she should respect or she shouldn't feel entitled to my time and attention and blah, 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 blah. But then it's like, look, if I call you, you better pick up the phone. If I text you, you better answer in 5 minutes. Let me tell you. because then it's a big crisis. And it's, why aren't you answering me? What I have to say is important, blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, I have to look at my willingness in that situation. She's my sister. She's my sister. And we have a long, complicated history, obviously, our whole entire lives. But, you know, there was a lot of resentment, you know, when I first came to AA. It's dwindled and become about less important things. But, you know, I still behave in a way that is incredibly selfish with her. You know, I am incredibly selfish. And then it's like, the do I arouse jealousy? Like, on the surface, I'd be like, do I arouse jealousy? It's like, no. And then it's like, yeah, I probably do. When I look at my relationship with my parents and how they've kind of grown apart more, but I'm still like really close with my parents. Whenever I talk about stuff we did or stuff we talked about, or, you know, I can't wait to go see them on this day, this day, this day. And, you know, mom was talking about buying me a plane ticket, whatever it is. It's like, I don't consider that since she is not in that situation anymore, because she actually has like a career and like, you know, she's going back to nursing school and all this stuff. So, you know, I don't realize the way I am affecting other people when I don't actively think about it, when I don't pay attention. You know, I get selfish, and I am inconsiderate in so many different ways. And I didn't even really fully realize that or fully internalize that until I did this sex inventory with every major relationship in my life. It's like everything everybody else needs from me is an imposition, and it's inconvenient. But I never consider how I'm impacting other people. Or I'll call them and it'll be like, you know, somebody will answer and be like, hey, I'm at work, can I call you back? Even if it's just one of my friends. And I'll be like, oh yeah, 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 of course. And then like, if they don't call me back that night, I'm like, that's so mean. Why would they do that to me? And that's like, how many times do people call? I don't even pick up the phone because I don't feel like talking right then. I don't even say I'm going to call them back. I just call them back when I feel like it. And that seems so little, but it's the little things that will eat at me. You know, it's the little things that will cause these problems, and they'll build up. And it's like, if I can excuse selfishness there, then I can excuse selfishness here. If I can excuse dishonesty there, I can excuse it here. And, you know, another thing that was explained to me early on in sobriety is it gets easier to do the wrong thing every time I do it. You know, the first time I lie, it might be tough, but then the next time it's easier, and it gets a little easier and a little easier. And then all of a sudden, honesty is not even important to me anymore because I'm lying just as well as I was before I got here. And, you know, this stuff just builds up. That's why I have to catch it when it's small. That's why it was so important for me to go through this inventory, you know, with a fine tooth comb and look at every single thing. You know, how do I behave in these ways? How am I selfish, inconsiderate, you know, self-seeking? All of these ideas come together, you know, to show me that truly what I'm doing is trying to run the show. I'm relying on myself instead of God. And I'm putting these unrealistic expectations on people and then getting resentful when they don't meet the expectations that I made up in my head. And it just sheds a whole new light on all my relationships and my own behavior. And it all just, it's like most of this resentment just melted away after going through the inventory, because it was like, oh my God, it's me. That's all I got on that.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, it says in here sex, and then it says they think we do not have enough of it, or isn't that the right kind? Enough of it? Jesus, I was so scared I was never going to have sex my whole life. I couldn't even look at another person. You know, I was like, why, you know, what, when is this going to happen? You know, those are the kind of crazy things I used to think about. And, you know, I never realized that when I was drinking, even though I was married twice when I was drinking, and I'm married now to my second wife, that sex wasn't about Mike just hurting someone else or feeling good, because that's what I did. You know, it wasn't about building a relationship. I wasn't into it for that. You know, that wasn't what sex was about. I was going to have it, and I was going to have a lot of it, and I wasn't going to care. And that sounds so, right now, coming out of my mouth, sounds so terrible, but it's the truth. It's just, you know, I'd get drunk. I'd run the streets. I'd be in places I shouldn't have been, and I didn't care. And that's not a great way to live, but that's what happened. You know, and down here when it says we don't want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct, you know, I don't want to be the arbitrator really of anybody's conduct in anything. You know, if you want to go bankrupt, call me. Ask me about managing your money. I'll show you how to do that. I went bankrupt once and was on the verge the second time. I'll take care of you. You know, if you want some marital advice, please talk to me. I've gotten divorced once and I'm still married to my second wife. And we've been separated 5 times. You know, I'm good at being married. Come on, ask me. I'll tell you. You know, so I shouldn't have anything to do with that, you know, but I will say this. In this program, when you talk to other people and you help other people, you learn something about yourself and you help yourself. And this came to me one time. I was on this panel and we spoke in Suffolk and it was just 3 of us. And it was about sex, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay. And then afterwards, they ask us questions. Well, this guy, he was truthful. He was like 20, 21 years old. He goes, I'm just getting sober and I'm at these meetings and I'm trying to be sober, but I see all these girls and I cannot stop hitting on them and I want to have sex with all of them. What's wrong with me? When is this going to change? And all of this. And, you know, I raised my hand. I said, I'll answer that. I couldn't believe what came out of my mouth. And what came out of my mouth was this. I said, man, when you get this program and you get sober and you learn how to practice all these principles in all your affairs, sex doesn't become that little tiny word, sex, you know, that people go, ooh. When you care, even if it's, you know, one night stand or whatever you're going to do, if you just have some kind of feeling for the other person, if that matters to you, you know, if the other person has feelings or the other person just is there, you know, is another person. I used to not think that, you know, I just do it and be gone, you know, whatever. I don't care what you feel like. I don't care anything. But when I got sober, it took me a long time to realize that sex is more than the act, you know, it's about giving a crap about the other person. And he's looking at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, I was kind of looking at myself like I was crazy because I couldn't believe it was coming out of my mouth because that's not how I acted when I was drinking. But as I learned through a sponsor and I learned through the big book and I learned through the steps, it's like when I honestly care for someone else, that's when I know. And in the sex, that's when I know that I'm doing this right, that I'm doing this program right, that it's all just not about Mike anymore. You know, sex used to just be about my feelings, me feeling good, whatever. And, you know, I didn't tell him don't have sex. I didn't tell him whatever, but I said, you'll know, cause he asked, when will I have it? This idea. And I said, you know, when you start caring about other people. So thanks.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next reading is on page 69. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Shannon.
All right, so that first paragraph, those specific questions, right? So the first time I did an inventory, it wasn't really you know, a big deal, not much to go on. But, you know, when I went to Christopher Newport University, right, I left for school. I lived on campus. I was 2 years sober. Yeah, I'd just gotten 2 years sober. And I mean, so of course I'm terrified. I'm on a college campus and I'm a 21-year-old alcoholic. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to die. But it was fine, actually. AA in Newport News is all right. But no, so I dated this guy and it was terrible. Like, I can be honest about this now. It was terrible. And I felt like I was the victim at the end of all of it, right? But of course, in typical Shannon fashion, it wasn't like some calm, mature conversation about why this isn't working. It was us flipping out at each other and like screaming anyway. So I knew in that moment, as it was happening, as I was saying things, I was like, this sucks. I'm going to have to make amends because I can't live treating people like that. Right. Anyway. So I did that just to get it out of the way, honestly. I mean, I did genuinely feel sorry for the things that I said. And I apologized and I meant it. You know, and after that, I sat down and I did an inventory and I asked myself those questions. And, you know, I went through it with a sponsor. And it was so funny when I look at my initial idea is I'm the victim and he was so bad to me and he was the dishonest one and he was doing this and that and blah, 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 all a million examples I could give you, right? But what I didn't think of until I really inventoried it is like, I had a big part in this relationship too. I was literally half of it, right? And you know, direct and clear communication does not translate immediately to honesty. It doesn't. You know, and I want to act like it does because it's like, okay, well, I think something, I'm going to say it. And like, that's great. That's all well and good. But it's also about things you don't say. And it's also about, you know, topics you don't approach. It's also, it's a dishonesty can have like a billion different forms. It doesn't just mean I didn't outright tell a lie, you know? And, you know, I was deeply selfish in it because things weren't going the way that I wanted them to go, the way I thought they should go. And, you know, he wasn't who I thought he should be. And it just, oh my God, this, by the way, this only lasted 5 months with like such a massive mess was made. And, you know, but I learned so much that I really needed to learn, which was that, you know, I am selfish without knowing it. Right. I want something from somebody, whether or not they can give it to me. And they don't even know. They don't even know what they need to be doing in my eyes. But I'm going to get resentful. And, you know, I can't expect people to give me what they do not have, you know, and it doesn't have to be a fault with them. Like, I didn't have to make it like, yeah, obviously my feelings were hurt, but I didn't have to make it about he's the bad guy and I'm the good guy. You know, it doesn't have to be that. It can be we're very different people. We were at two very different places in our lives. We were trying to force it to work and it wasn't going to work. And that's on both of us. And I absolutely play my part, but I love to act like I don't. You know, I love to act like it has nothing to do with me. I take my inventory in my head. I come up 100%. And that's why I have to do this with other people. I have to be guided by a power greater than myself, because if I'm not actually doing the work, you know, somebody when I very first got to AA, like when I was coming to AA once a week because my parents were dropping me off up the street, you know, somebody told me you have to do the 12 steps, you can't just think through them. And I was like, yeah, well, you're not me, you don't get it, I can think through anything. And I thought my way through the 12 steps and drank for the next 9 months. And it didn't work because I can't do it alone. I can't do it in my head, or I'm not going to get to the meat and potatoes of this whole thing. You know, I'm not going to have the answers that A, I'm looking for, and B, I need to change my behavior and do better. And it's so funny to me to look back on it now. And it's like, I mean, it's not like it's a world of difference. I mean, I'm only 23 and I'm just hit 5 years sober, but I learned so much just from that one relationship, right? That it's like, after that, I didn't try to shape my ideals. I asked God to shape my ideals. And I'm very different in a lot of regards now, where it's like, you know, I can't put this expectation on people. I've never been the type of person who needs to be in a relationship, you know? Like, I knew a lot of people in high school, a lot of girls in high school who were like, always needed to have a boyfriend. I've really never been like that. But it helped shape things instead of what do I want from somebody? It's what can I bring to the table? What do I have to offer? You know, and it's changed so much, and I have to. In all of my relationships, answer those questions. What am I doing to the other person? Am I inflicting pain? Because I am not always the victim. I'm not always the good guy. And the other person is not always the bad guy. Unfortunately, I'd love if it was that easy, but it's not. And it's not that simple. And, you know, just my relationships with everybody in my life in general, you know, upon realizing that it's not always black and white, good, bad, here's the problem, it's your fault, it's my fault. It's so much more complicated than that. And, you know, being able to do an inventory with a sponsor and go through these questions and connect with other alcoholics and a higher power, you know, it starts to make a little bit more sense than when I sit there and try to think through it in my own head. So thanks.
Beautiful. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah. You know, this first paragraph, it looks like now we're starting to put this down on paper. And it's hard because the first sentence says we viewed our conduct over the years past. I didn't want to do that. You know, I did not want to look at how I treated other people, especially in the sex conduct, you know, because it says up here, where was I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Who'd I hurt? Did we arouse jealousy, suspicion? I did all of that. That was, and I was doing it when I was drunk and I didn't consciously know I was doing it, but man, I was doing it. And the thing that I did the most of was my wife was home taking care of the kids. She was running the household, doing everything she could to hold it together, you know, to hold this family together. And I'd go, well, you're out running around, you're sleeping with people, you're doing this and that, you're all over the place, blah, blah, blah. She wasn't doing anything, nothing. But I was so wrong that I had to turn it on her. And I just did. And that's what I did. I said, oh, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're out. How could she be out? She was taking care of kids, taking care of the babies, balancing the budget of the money that I was stealing, you know, doing everything to hold this whole family together. And I kept turning it on her and made her, honestly, made her crazy. Because, you know, you do it enough, you can convince somebody else that they're doing something, you know? And it was awful. And I didn't consciously think that I was doing that, maybe. And that's not an excuse, because when I had to go look at it and put it on paper and review my conduct over the years past, it's exactly what I did. And it was terrible. And in the second paragraph, it says, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. Again, I was 45 years old when I got sober. I'm 57 now, and I'm still don't understand it all, you know, of sex. I don't, you know, sex is more than the act, and it still confuses me. You know, it's telling her she's beautiful after she's had a hard day. It's just touching her hand, you know, it's you know, being there, it's giving her something when she doesn't expect it, it's satisfying her needs and not mine, you know. I have two adult children and one that's still at home, and he's a teenager, and I've said this before, a couple years ago, he spent the night with somebody, our girls are gone, they were out, and my wife was just sitting there, and we were watching TV, and she said, come over here and sit with me and put your arm around me. And I go, why? What are we doing here? What are you talking about? And I couldn't understand that that was part of it, of building a relationship, you know, and that has to do with sex. You know, I have to, it's pretty much a body, mind, and a whole soul, just like being sober. It encompasses all those things. And I still have to learn about that, you know, and what happened when I wrote that inventory, what really hit me in the head is it's not about you, Mike. Stop, you know, stop using people, stop hurting people, help other people, give to other people. And, you know, this program has taught me that, you know, do the next right thing and things will be good. So thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you guys. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I'm going to read two final readings and we'll leave it there. Also on page 69, whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. And finally, page 70. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Like to say a big thank you to Mike and Janin for being here and sharing tonight. Super awesome. And I'd like to encourage everybody to stick around after the meeting. We'll unmute you and let you thank them in person. We're now going to pass the seventh tradition basket. I posted the link a little bit earlier and David has just shared it. Thank you. Seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. At this time, does anybody have any AA-related announcements? You can raise your hand or actually. I am not seeing anybody with announcements. All right. Moving on. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting in the Zoom room. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we'll be available in the Zoom room after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us, or if you're shy, feel free to email us at info@simpleactions.net. And in closing, let's have a nice, quiet round of applause for Mike and Shannon one more time. And thank you to all who participated. We're going to unmute everyone after the Lord's Prayer and give you a chance to say thank you. And I have asked David to read the last two paragraphs on page 164, which I will pull up.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic named David. Thank you, Shannon and Mike. That was amazing tonight. On 164, A Vision for You, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless and bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Thank you. And we all close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen.
Woohoo!
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Shannon.
So thank good. You
both. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Shannon, you crushed it. And Mike, as always, it's wonderful to hear you.